gulped and took Avon's hand. Burton and his men marched their captives away from the beach and into the woods. The captors formed a ring around the companions, but Burton walked in front, and John noticed, as did the others, that he kept and carried the Imaginarium Geographica. They walked at a brisk but bearable pace for almost an hour before finally arriving at their destination. The eerie, cold light above was beginning to fade, to be replaced by the warm glow of firelight from the settlement ahead. The village of the Croatoans was set in a small valley deep within the pine forest. It was bracketed by tall bluffs on two sides, and a shallow creek ran through it to the south. There were several dozen buildings of simple construction, wood and wattle lodges mostly, although there were shingles on the roofs of several buildings, and almost all of them had at least one glass window. The tribe took little notice of most of the companions, as if marching a group of prisoners through the village were an everyday occurrence. But every villager they passed took special notice of Laura Glue. This didn't go unseen by the girl, and she gripped Avon's hand all the tighter. In the center of the village was a great circle of stones, like low altars, and adjacent to each stone was a fire that had been stoked to blazing. As they approached, Bert couldn't contain the sigh of relief that escaped his lips. In the center of the firelight was the indigo dragon. Not the entire ship, but the living masthead.
"Oh, thank goodness," said Bert. "At least they rescued her."
"Rescued?" said Burton.
"Hardly. The indigo dragon was our first prisoner. We just went back for the rest of you."
"How did you know she's called the indigo dragon?" asked John. Burton tipped his head at Bert.
"Ask him. I'm sure he knows who I am."
Bert glared at their adversary, which was a surprise to John. Bert hardly ever glared at anybody.
"You've all heard of him, I believe," Bert told the others, "or at least have a passing familiarity with his writings. What you don't know is that Charles Dickens chose him as an apprentice caretaker, with Nemo's blessing. But it didn't work out, and he was dismissed."
"Was that before or after Magwitch?" asked Charles.
"Does it matter?" said Jack.
"Good point," said Charles.
"He faked his own death and disappeared," Bert informed them. "No one expected to hear from him again."
"A fair enough assessment," said Burton.
"I had made a fortune with my books and decided to create a new future for myself in the archipelago of dreams. I had been here again for only a short while when I became caught up in a terrible storm. When it finally passed, I found myself here, and my ship was destroyed. The Croatoans nursed me back to health, and as payment, I let them make me their leader."
The companions' heads were spinning with a thousand questions, but as usual, it was Avon who returned them to the matters at hand.
"I'm glad you rescued the indigo dragon," she said. "But what of her crew? There were more than 20 fauns aboard. Were any of them injured?"
"Not to begin with," Burton replied. "But they put up much more of a fight than you lot did."
"And so you killed them," Avon exclaimed. "What a waste of life."
"Oh, they weren't wasted," Burton said. "In fact, they were delicious."
The companions were speechless with shock, except for Avon.
"Barbarian," she exclaimed. "You're no better than a Wendigo."
"Rightly so," said Burton. "We men of the West have always been more barbaric than our counterparts in the East. How much more so might we be, now that we're in the westernmost lands that exist?"
Near the ring of stone and fire was a large structure that appeared to be the central meeting house for the Croatoans. The companions were allowed to sit on mats that were laid along the center of the building, and they took in their strange surroundings. The walls were lined with great carved chairs, like the British Parliament, and the room was brightly lit with torches that were Norse, according to John. The mats on which they sat were Persian, as were the tapestries adorning the walls and draped over the chairs. Burton took his place on a pedestal at the far end, and other officious-looking members of the Croatoans filed in and took the rest of the seats. With pomp and flourish, Burton introduced the members of the Indian Council as they entered. It was slightly disconcerting to the companions to see men dressed so strangely and speaking in unusual tongues, introduced as Murthwaite and Kelso and Jiggs and Barnaby. There were more traditional Indian names as well, often attached to European ones, in an unusual but nearly seamless marriage of cultures.
"This is almost a textbook model of cultural democracy," whispered Jack. "I'd love to do an actual case study on how they came to implement it. It probably helped things along that they were trapped in the underneath,"
Charles whispered back.
"Not necessarily,"
noted Jack.
"They probably just ate anyone who disagreed with them."
Most of the Indian elders sat cross-legged in the broad chairs along the walls, while two of them, whom Burton had indicated as his aides-de-camp, sat on the pedestal with him, though on noticeably lower seats nearer the back. The first, the man called Murthwaite, wore a broad moustache and thick glasses, and was scrupulously taking notes on everything said and done.
"Secretary-General," whispered Charles.
"Indeed," said Bert.
The other aide was a dusky-skinned, full-blooded Indian Burton called Hairy Billy. He was naked from the waist up, save for several strings of beads and elaborate necklaces that lay on his chest, and had taken a curious interest in Avon. Avon, for her part, regarded him coolly, but gave no indication that she noticed the unusual attentions.
"But he's bald," said Laura Glue. "Why do you call him Hairy Billy?"
Burton smiled and crouched down in front of the girl.
"Once, when he was much younger, he crossed the waters here to a forbidden island, where the children all choose their own names. And although he was rescued later, he insisted we call him by his new name. So we let him keep it, but we took something else."
He gestured at the Indian, who gave a wide, open-mouthed smile in return, revealing the fact that he had no tongue. It had been cut out. Laura Glue shuddered and shrank back from Burton, who grinned more broadly and stood up.
"Discipline," he said to no one in particular. "It's a harsh lesson to learn, but necessary. And lessons we learn through pain are seldom forgotten."
This last he said while fingering the deep scars on his cheeks, before he snapped out of his reverie and turned to Bert.
"I suppose these are your apprentices, eh, caretaker?" said Burton. "Full caretakers," Bert replied. "The very ones who defeated the Winter King."
At the mention of their old adversary, Burton's eyes glittered, and he took a renewed interest in the three young men.
"I have heard of you," he said slowly. "The three scholars who changed the course of the world's destiny. I suppose the prophecy would have been fulfilled sooner or later. Else what's a prophecy for?"
"Prophecy?" said John.
"For another time," Bert said hurriedly. "What do you want of us, Sir Richard?"
Burton laughed.
"The honorific is not necessary. At any rate, it doesn't apply here. The hierarchy is determined first by age, then by strength and ability, and I'm first among equals in both categories. You may address me as Elder, or if you prefer, simply Burton."
"When we met Burton," said Charles, "you introduced yourself as a representative of the Imperial Cartological Society. Is that an organization of the Empire? I'm afraid I never heard of it."
Burton swiveled around.
"Indeed. It is of the Empire, and it was sanctioned by Victoria herself. After my enlightening but brief apprenticeship as a caretaker with Dickens, I continued researching the history of the Geographica and the Archipelago on my own, and I made a surprising discovery. There had been many apprentice caretakers throughout history who, like myself, were trained, then abandoned. For cause," Bert said mildly. "An opinion," Burton shot back, "of one viewing the situation from a privileged position."
"Well, why were you set aside?"
Charles asked.
"Because," replied Burton, I disagreed with one of the fundamental rules of looking after the Imaginarium Geographica, that it, and everything having to do with the Archipelago of Dreams, must be kept secret from the world. Nemo and I had many violent arguments about it, but in the end, he left the decision to Dickens, and I was shut out.
"You don't think knowledge of the archipelago would be too great a burden for the common man?" asked Jack.
"Knowledge is a responsibility," John said, nodding. "But most people don't know they are ready for it until they already have it, and by then it's too late."
"Really?" said Burton. "John, isn't it? Isn't that how you came by the job, by having it thrust upon you?"
"He was being trained," countered Bert. "He has the temperament. Surely even you can see this. That's much different."
"Is it?" said Burton.
"The only difference I see is that I have more faith in mankind's ability to bear the burden. I think they will be able to take it. More, I think it is their right. The world and the archipelago were once one. It was only because of their separation that someone decided the archipelago should be kept secret, and because of that one foolish choice, the world has been starved of treasures and resources we should have claimed long ago. So I took my argument to the Queen, who sanctioned a private organization, the Imperial Cartological Society, to begin keeping records, making maps, and funding exploratory ventures that would not be a hostage to the caretakers."
"Private, eh?" said John.
"Now who's keeping secrets?"
"A necessary function at the onset," retorted Burton. "Else we'd have risked being discovered by those like yourself, and possibly losing our greatest resources."
"What resources?" Bert asked.
"We have our own apprentices in the society," said Burton, "and we wanted them as untainted as possible, or converted to our cause, before you could reach them."
"I don't know," said Jack. "I was pretty young when I was recruited into all this."
"We get them younger still," said Burton, "so that if they're approached by one of you, they already believe in a different agenda."
Bert's eyes widened in horror as he realized whom Burton was referring to.
"Harry. You mean Harry and Conan Doyle, don't you?"
Burton laughed again, and it was at once mocking and triumphant.
"How do you think the Winter King and his minions were able to track you so quickly?" he said. "They nearly caught you that night in London, didn't they?"
John felt the blood drain from his face.
"How could you know about our meeting at the club in London when you've been trapped down here?"
"I get reports from those who sometimes fall into the underneath," said Burton, "as well as from books, newspapers, and diaries that come with the occasional ship. I read about the break-in at 221B Baker Street in a copy of the Illustrated London News that came down with a dory, and your adventures in the archipelago became the stuff of legend fast enough, so I put the pieces together. And as to the Winter King, how do you think he was able to operate so easily in your world, if not for the help of those who shared his goals?"
"World domination?" John said wryly.
"No," said Burton. "World reunification."
Charles was still processing Burton's revelation.
"So Harry Houdini and Arthur Conan Doyle were..."
"My apprentices," Burton confirmed. "I recruited them before you and that idiot Verne had the chance to."
He gestured brusquely at Bert.
"They were barely more than boys, but they had the minds for it, and the will to defy those who would keep this knowledge for themselves."
"So for decades now," said Jack, "there has been, what, a counter-caretaker organization, run by the British Crown?"
"Victoria may have sanctioned the society, but the seeds of its founding were Elizabethan,"
Burton said, turning again to Bert.
"Surely you know to whom I'm referring."
Bert's face darkened.
"That's apocryphal. There's no evidence of John Dee's betrayal. Not that it has any bearing on us now.
Burton crossed his arms and began to pace, as if giving a lecture.
No? Then think on this. How many caretakers have been formally enlisted throughout history?
Formally, said John.
That's easy enough to guess. Most of their signatures are inside the Geographica. Right, said Burton. 3 every generation or so, for several hundred years. But consider, how many more, like myself, were initiated into the mysteries of the Geographica and the archipelago, only to be cast aside when they were deemed unworthy?
If Magwitch is any example of one who was cast out,
put in Charles,
then I'd say it was pretty justified.
I can't argue with you there, Burton said. But not all of those chosen were top-notch either. Cervantes is a good example of that. Can you imagine anything worse than a caretaker who actually loses the Geographica?
I'm sure he had other good qualities, Jack said, trying not to look at John, who swallowed hard and blushed. But setting aside Magwitch, isn't it possible there were valid reasons the other, apprentice caretakers were rejected?
No,
Burton shouted.
It wasn't that they were unqualified, but rather because of the same inconsequential difference of opinion that cost me the opportunity. They each disagreed with the first fundamental rule of being a caretaker of the Imaginarium Geographica. Secrecy, said Bert. Yes, Burton roared, eyes ablaze. The damned secrecy. Keeping the wonders and marvels of the archipelago of dreams confined to the libraries and offices of a few secular scholars. Even the selection process itself is offensive. The caretakers are supposed to be among the greatest, most creative thinkers of the world. But for centuries, the position has been reserved mostly for light-skinned Europeans, and even among them, mostly scholars from Oxford. That's part of what I founded the society to change.
He circled his captives, feral, hefting the Geographica in his hands.
It was my mandate from Queen Victoria herself, Burton said, to acquire the Imaginarium Geographica and replicate it, to make copies of it so that any man, woman or child, whatever race, religion or creed, could have a copy for themselves.
Burton lifted the book over his head, and his voice rang throughout the small valley.
I intend to make this the rarest of books, so common that it can be purchased on any street corner.
The sound of Burton's proclamation rang and echoed throughout the structure, and to his surprise, the companions merely blinked and smiled.
Ah,
Charles began,
I really don't know how to tell you this, old fellow, because I don't want to dampen your spirits about something that obviously means a great deal to you. But it's been done.
Burton paused for a moment, then lowered the book and squinted menacingly at Charles.
What do you mean?
I mean, Charles continued, you're a bit behind the times. An enterprising badger named Tumbler has been publishing copies of the Geographica for almost a decade now. There were several copies on the Indigo Dragon. It's in its 4th printing now.
5th, said Bert.
Pardon, said Charles. 5th.
The expressions on the faces of the other companions told Burton that Charles spoke the truth. He looked closely at Bert.
And you agreed with this? You allowed it to be duplicated for anyone to own?
Anyone in the archipelago, yes, said Bert. I still stand by my oath as a caretaker. Open knowledge of the archipelago is too dangerous to be released into the world. Or, he added, watched over by those who cannot be trusted to guard its secrets.
Burton's response was a look of fury and a brutal, open-handed slap across Bert's jaw. Avon cried out in anger, and the Council of Indian Elders rose to their feet with a clamour of shouts and harsh language. Murthwaite began blowing into a conch shell and calling for order, and Laura Glue crawled underneath one of the unoccupied chairs to hide. With a gesture, Burton quieted the room, then turned back to the companions. The fury was not gone, but merely subdued.
"I've allowed my own desires to direct the tenor of our discussion," he said in a low, even voice. "We have brought you before the Council of Elders for something more important. And while it's likely that you will be put to death, I give you my word as a gentleman that it will be swift and painless if you answer my question, and answer it honestly. What have you done with our children?"
John, visibly relaxed. Perhaps the fear and concern behind that question was the reason for their brusque treatment, and this might even give them an opportunity for a non-lethal resolution after all. "Whatever our differences regarding the Geographica and our role as caretakers," he said, "I think we are more alike than you know. The reason we are here in the Underneath is that we are seeking our own children. The children of the archipelago, including her son," he nodded at Avon, "have gone missing. Our mission is the same, Burton."
"Is that so?" Burton sneered. "Then how do you explain her?"
He was pointing at Laura Glue, still hiding under the chair.
"If your children are missing too, how was she spared?"
"It was Grandfather," Laura Glue said defensively. "He knew how to keep me from the men."
"Which men?"
Burton asked, still suspicious.
"The men with the clocks in their bellies," said Laura Glue. "They came to get us, and he sent me away. He put plugs of beeswax in my ears and said they would keep me safe."
"Beeswax?"
Burton snorted.
"Of what good is beeswax?"
"I suspect that the children were lured away somehow," offered Bert. "The beeswax may have been meant to block out the sound."
"Impossible," Burton said. "We Chromatoans keep sentries, and they are well trained. None of them heard any clockwork men, not a toot, whistle, plunk or boom. We didn't see or hear the children being taken," he continued, "until it was too late, and I heard a single child, my own daughter, Lilith, cry out. When we got to the shore, we saw them running about in the darkness. They were all children, being directed by one they called Stephen. We rushed toward them, but it was too late. The children were being taken away in ships. Living ships," he added with a snarl and a dark look at Bert. "And in moments, they had vanished completely. And there is only one enemy we have had these many years whose army consists of children."
"The Lost Boys aren't an army,"
Laura Glue said hotly, forgetting her fear and clambering from under the chair.
"We're just children, and that's it, and that's all."
The surprise in Burton's face was surpassed only by the expressions of the Indian elders. They were genuinely shocked, appalled, and even fearful at the child's mention of the Lost Boys. Burton gestured to Hairy Billy, who moved with a swiftness that belied his bulk, and in a flash had Laura Glue locked in his arms, immobile. Burton stepped closer and sniffed at her like an animal appraising.
"I thought you smelled familiar," he murmured. "You have the stink of the pan, unless I miss my guess."
"Grandfather doesn't stink," cried Laura Glue, "except after dinner sometimes, but he pretends he's asleep."
"Grandfather, eh?"
Burton said with a sideways glance at the elders.
"I think we now have something with which to barter for our children's release."
"But we just explained to you," said Charles. "We didn't have anything to do with your missing children."
"And yet," said Burton, drawing a finger along the girl's cheek, "we found you on our shores, in possession of a living ship, accompanied by the progeny of our great adversary. I think someone is lying to me, and that is a very dangerous thing to do."
He barked a few curt words in a language none of them understood, and with that, the council was ended. Ignoring their protests and exclamations of anger, Burton took Laura Glue by the hand and Avon by the shoulder and led them both out of the lodge. At Murthwaite's direction, several other burly men joined Hairy Billy in pulling the companions to their feet and marching them briskly out of the building and down a small path that led away from the main settlement. As they marched, the companions realized that the guards were far enough away that they wouldn't be overheard, and so they immediately began to formulate a whispered plan of action. The first order of business was rescuing Avon and Laura Glue.
"Not to be a wet blanket," said Charles, "but we need the Geographica, too. There's too much in it we may yet need if we're to rescue all the children."
"I'm not leaving them to Burton," whispered Jack,
"especially Laura Glue. You saw how he looked at her when he realized her lineage."
"Of course," said John, "we won't leave her, or Avon either. And we do need the Geographica. But we're outmatched, outnumbered, and have no real idea where we are or where we're to go if we can escape."
"Technicalities," muttered Charles, eyeing the silent guards around them.
"I don't think we can leave," Bert said suddenly. "The clues we've been looking for might be right here."
"Can't leave?" John exclaimed.
"Good heavens, Bert, why in blazes not?"
"Two reasons," said Bert, his face darkening. "One, Burton referred to the ships that took their children as living ships. So I think I know what's happened to our missing dragon ships and to what use they're being put."
"Agreed," said Charles. "They're being used by this Stephen rogue to kidnap children."
"That's what makes the second reason even worse," said Bert in a choked voice. "Much worse."
"Why?" asked John.
"Because," Bert said, turning to look at Jack, "the name of Avon's son, the kidnapped prince, my grandson, is Stephen."
Chapter 15. Haven. The Croatoans put their captives in a small lodge made of wicker and animal skins, but that nonetheless also had leaded glass windows. It might have seen other uses, but it was obvious to them all that this was now their prison. The fires outside were allowed to burn down to embers, and eventually the settlement grew quiet as deep night descended on the underneath. In the lodge, the companions slept, and sleeping, they dreamed. Not dreams of their recent adventures and ordeals, but dreams that seemed to be searching for the meaning that lay beneath all that had transpired. John had no fear. He had often wondered what it meant to be afraid of something, but in the years since the war, he had gradually come to realize that nothing made him afraid. He had witnessed the deaths of many friends and had seen himself placed in mortal danger, and he had emerged from those experiences changed for the better, he hoped. But unlike the physical changes borne by those who had been wounded in some way, John's change was invisible. He was no longer afraid of death. His new attribute showed itself not through an irrational recklessness, but rather in a disregard for any personal price he might pay for a course of action. The best word he could use to describe this awareness was from India, satyagraha. It meant to do anything, give anything, sacrifice anything, to pursue what was right without harming another, and to do it without regard to self. The only fear John had was for his children. He had often dreamed of them falling from a great height and just out of his reach, falling like Icarus flown too close to the sun, too far away for a father to save. Sometimes he dreamed that he could almost reach them, and once, when the dream was of his eldest son, he dreamed that he extended his hand and grazed the boy's fingers before he fell. Thereafter, he determined that if the boy was close enough to touch, he was close enough to hold and save, and that played constantly in John's thoughts afterward. Chopping firewood for the household stove, he sometimes imagined that a large split log was a child's hand, and he carried it from the woodpile to the hearth, using only the tips of his fingers, holding on by the least, most tenuous grasp. He often lost the wood, as the splinters it left reminded him, but he grew stronger, and eventually he could carry a huge log between his fingers as far as he chose to walk, without risk of dropping it. After that, he still dreamed of children falling, but he never again failed to save them. Jack dreamed about desire. Not so much about the desire for things, or desire to be something, but about the meaning of desire. And in that way, he also dreamed of fear. As a child, he once dreamed that he could leave behind the dreary life he saw ahead of him and go to a place where he could be a child forever. And he knew that he desired it. But awake or asleep, he chose to smother his desire. As he grew older, his dreams manifested themselves in action, and he followed his desire to be a hero and have a life of grand adventure. But his fears were also realized, and those close to him paid a dear price. And again, he put away his desire. Now, he was torn between what he wanted to do and what he knew he must do. And it seemed that the two were often the same, but he could never be sure. And, unable to decide, Jack ceased dreaming and slept fitfully the rest of the night. Charles also dreamed, and in his dream he could fly, and it was glorious. Dawn, or whatever it was that passed for dawn in the underneath, was still to come when the companions were awakened by someone poking at them in the darkness. It was Laura Glue.
"Come on," the girl whispered anxiously. "We've got to leave now. It's almost morning."
"What happens in the morning?"
said Charles, still groggy from sleep.
"And, weren't you a prisoner like us? How did you get free?"
The girl shook her head, almost frantic.
"No time, no time. We have to go now."
She untied Charles, who then helped her to free the others, and carefully they opened the door of the lodge. Outside, the two stocky men appointed as guards were lying on the ground in poses that suggested unconsciousness rather than sleep.
"We bonked them on the noggins,"
Laura Glue whispered.
"Took 'em right out."
"We?"
said Jack. In response, Laura Glue pointed to two shadows standing at the base of one of the bluffs that bracketed the settlement. It was Avon, who was waving and looking around to make certain they were unobserved, and one other.
"Hairy Billy," John said suspiciously as they approached. "Isn't he Burton's toady?"
"Perhaps," said Avon, who was hugging her father. "But once he was a boy called Joe Clements, who ran away from home to become a lost boy. He was one of the last full-blood Algonquin among the Croatoans, and they mocked him, calling him Injun Joe. So he went someplace where he could choose a new name, his own name, with us."
"How do you know we can trust him?"
asked Charles. In answer, Hairy Billy pushed aside his ornate necklaces and showed them a plain leather cord looped through a silver thimble, identical to Laura Glue's. The massive, barrel-chested Indian turned and pulled something from a bramble bush that he handed to John. It was the Imaginarium Geographica. John started to stammer a thank you, but Hairy Billy merely smiled his open-mouthed, grotesquely tongueless smile, then turned and motioned for them all to follow. Jack grinned.
"Burton thought he was so clever with his secret society and covert agents," he said.
"He didn't realize it works both ways." In silence, they followed the Indian through the underbrush of the pine forest for almost a quarter of an hour before finally emerging into a broad clearing. There ahead of them was the unmistakable rise of another island, and in between, nothing but a mile or so of moist sand. In the distance was a sound of thunder, which grew louder with each passing second.
"That's not thunder,"
Laura Glue said when she realized they were scanning the sky for storm clouds.
"We have to hurry, please."
Hairy Billy made several motions with his hands, indicating that he could go no farther with them, then squeezed Avon's shoulder briefly and disappeared into the trees. Back in the direction from which they'd come, there arose a great hue and cry and a roaring of fury that could only have come from Burton.
"Our absence has been noted," said Bert. "We'd best hurry along."
"To what end?" said John, scanning the expanse ahead of them. "They'll be on us in a few minutes, and then we'll be back where we started. Only this time, there'll be no pacifying Burton."
"Listen to her," cried Avon.
grabbing Laura with one hand and Bert with the other.
Just follow us and try to keep up.
With that, the three took off at a dead run across the sand. John, Jack, and Charles had little choice but to follow. It was when the companions were almost halfway across the expanse of sand that their pursuers burst out of the forest and onto the sand. Turning to gauge their pursuit, the caretakers suddenly realized what the increasingly loud sound was. It was not thunder. It was the incoming tide, and it was rushing across the sand with terrifying speed.
"Step in time, gentlemen,"
John yelled as he picked up his pace. Up ahead, Avon, Laura Glue, and Bert had nearly reached the nearby high ground, which, in just a few moments, would be an island. The sound of the water was so deafening now that they could no longer hear the cries of their pursuers, but a stolen glance back told them that a number of Croatoans had indeed followed them out onto the sand. The force of the water was pushing a wall of air before it that nearly knocked them off of their feet, and the spray from the foam had already soaked them to the skin before they reached the cluster of rocks where the other three were waiting anxiously. John reached the rocks first, then Jack, and finally, the water crashing down at his heels, Charles. Just inches away, a flood of biblical proportions filled the expanse between them and Croatoan Island, and as far as the eye could see. The noise it brought was a sound of ragged beauty. The harmonies of a wall of water falling into a narrow space speak of chaos and strength and inevitability, and they are beautiful in their terrible splendor. The Croatoans, foolish enough to pursue them, didn't even have time to scream before being swept away, while on the opposite shore, Burton and the rest of their pursuers had been completely cut off by the thundering waves.
"Mustn't we keep running?"
Charles said to the others, who were watching the roiling waters rush by.
"It's going to settle in a few minutes, and they'll just be after us again."
Laura Glue giggled, shook her head, and pointed. Out in the water was one of the Croatoans, who'd been identified at the council as Jinty. He was nearly 7 feet tall, and his great stride had allowed him to far outpace the others, trapping him in the onrushing tide. But instead of pushing forward, he seemed to be frantically trying to get back to the dry shore where Burton and the rest had stopped. He was mere yards from safety when a great beast, which resembled a porpoise the size of a London bus, snatched him between jaws filled with needle-like teeth.
"That's just one of the little ones," said Laura Glue. "Until the tide goes out again tonight, no one's going to be chasing us."
In a flash, the girl's expression shifted from triumph to one of misery.
"Oh, no," she exclaimed. "I've lost my flower."
Jack placed a comforting hand on her shoulder.
"It's all right, Laura Glue. We don't need it any more. Not while we have you. You saved us again, didn't you?"
He bent down and kissed her lightly on the cheek.
"That, my dear girl, was a kiss," he said.
Laura Glue blushed.
"Jamie's kisses are prettier to look at," she said, smiling. "But that was okay, too. For a long beard."
The companions moved farther along the shoreline and began to explore the island the girl had led them to. It was not dissimilar to Croatoan Island, but it seemed older, more ancient. The trees were more deciduous than evergreen, and they radiated a scent of antiquity, as if they'd always been there. As if they'd always be there. But of all their reactions to this new topography, Avon's was the most profound. In direct contrast to their surroundings, she actually seemed younger, and it was then that her father realized where they were.
"This is it," Bert said, "isn't it? This is Jamie and Peter's Netherland."
"I think so," said Avon,
looking at Laura Glue, who was happily bobbing her head in agreement.
"It feels right. I can't say for certain until we've gone farther inland."
"This way,"
Laura Glue exclaimed, grabbing Avon and Jack by the hands.
"Follow me. I know the way."
With one last look across to the island, where shortly before they'd been held as prisoners, the companions stepped into the broadleaf forest and disappeared into the Netherland. Laura Glue marched them through increasingly dense foliage, often taking pathways that seemed to the others to be illogically convoluted. but she insisted that the twists and turns and switchbacks were necessary, and Avon generally agreed.
"The Lost Boys have been at war with the Indians for a long time," Avon told the others. "Booby-trapping the forest is one way to fend off any attacks, or at least slow them down long enough to warn us that enemies are coming."
"What kind of booby-traps?"
Charles said, craning his head around nervously.
"And are they effective?"
"Effective enough," replied Avon. "Peter gave the job to two brothers, the Skelton Boys, and just the initial tests were enough to keep the rest of us from tromping around out here without checking on where they put the traps."
"What happened during the tests?" asked Jack.
"That's when we give to the Skelton Boys their nicknames,"
Laura Glue put in.
"Stumpy and One Eye."
"Sorry I asked," said Jack. It took most of the day, or the day's equivalent in the underneath, for the companions to make their way through the forest. Occasionally, they heard the sounds of birds, but they neither saw nor heard any other creatures. But every so often, they could feel something watching. Bert, John, and Charles exchanged concerned glances, but Avon, Jack, and Laura Glue seemed not to notice. Avon, in particular, grew more and more animated as the trees began to thin and the terrain grew more hill-pocked. "Look," she exclaimed, jumping across a large boulder at the base of a huge oak.
"It's my house! Father, look!"
There, amidst the tangle of roots, was a child-sized set of furniture made of sticks woven together with reeds and sapling strips. There were remnants of what might have been a tea set scattered among the leaves and the forest debris, and underneath the table she found a tarnished, twisted silver spoon.
"This is where I used to play when I came here with Jamie," she said excitedly. "He helped me build the furniture, and we had a set of spoons he'd brought with him from London. We were the envy of all the Lost Boys, having real spoons for tea."
"Fascinating," said Charles.
"There are imaginary houses and tea rooms, like this one, set up all throughout the hills," Avon went on. "We're close now. We're very close."
With that, she carefully placed the spoon on the woodland table and turned to the others.
"Follow us," she said, taking Laura Glue's hand once more. "We know the way from here, and there aren't any more traps. I've come home."
Laura Glue and Avon took off at a quick clip, and the men had to lengthen their strides just to keep them in sight. The forest continued to thin, with the mighty oaks giving way to slighter, paler aspens and stout, bushy cedars. Eventually the trees stopped altogether, and there was nothing ahead but a high rise of coloured sand. Avon and Laura Glue were atop it and waving at the companions to join them.
"There,"
said Laura Glue, pointing to the near horizon.
"That's our city."
From a distance, what Laura Glue called a city looked like a fortress that fragmented into a cluster of volcanic flumes, rising high above multicolored but otherwise unimpressive dunes of sand and stone.
Is it behind the sand?"
asked Charles.
"It's no use just looking for our houses," said Laura Glue. "You won't see them. Not yet, anyways."
"Why not?" asked John.
"Well,"
Laura Glue replied,
"it's because here, in the Netherland, our houses are the exact opposite of your houses in Angleland. There you can see the houses in the day, but not when it gets dark. But here, it's exactly the opposite. Our houses are the colour of night, so you can't see them in the daytime, only at night." "You mean your houses are black?"
Charles asked. Laura Glue scowled.
"Of course not. Night isn't black. It's just dark. There's a difference, you know." "Sorry," said Charles. "The things that seem dull in the daytime are magic at night," said Laura Glue. "And that's where we live, in the magic houses."
"It is getting toward nightfall again," Bert observed, scanning the sky. "Will we see them soon?"
"Yes," said Avon, who was practically glowing with joy. "Just wait and watch."
The light of the underneath began to fade into slumbering pastels, and as it did, the city of the Lost Boys began to awaken. It was indistinct at first, small pinpoints of light here and there, but as the sky darkened, The lights became brighter and more colourful. The warmth of lanterns sprang up in cultivated rows, and sparkling lights that moved with life spun in circular angles, as if someone had electrified giant spiderwebs and draped them over the stone towers. As the lights appeared, the companions could see that it wasn't a desert at all, but an oasis filled with magic. There were pools of water reflecting the glittering homes above, and bridges connecting the towers that moments before had seemed only a mirage, a trick of the light. It was everything a magic city was supposed to be, and it could only have been created by children, for there was no board or brick of it that would have been imagined by an adult. And when adults saw it, it was not with grown-up eyes, but with the eyes of the children they had once been.
"Well, of course you can see it,"
Lauraglu said indignantly, in response to the exclamations of the others.
"I told you it was here.
We call it Haven."
At the edges of the city, set within broad stone walls, was a series of grates that were nearly covered over with warning and keep out signs. Lauraglu ignored them all and marched straight to a grate with a sign that read, "Speak the passwords or be kilt." Charles leaned toward the grate.
"Alakazam,"
he said loudly, to no effect.
"Nice try," offered John.
"Do you know the passwords?" Jack asked Lauraglu.
"Of course I do," she exclaimed. "You all just got me discombobulated, is all."
The girl tapped her forehead for a moment and pursed her lips. Then she leaned in close to the grate and began to call out the secret words, and was answered in turn by the voice of a gatekeeper somewhere within.
"Applecore."
"Baltimore."
"Who's your friend?"
"Me."
There was a gasp and a giggle, then the sound of a creaking, rusty mechanism being turned. Slowly the grate swung inward, and a light appeared in the tunnel below. A puckish face appeared, framed by an explosion of ribboned, light brown pigtails that stuck out in every direction.
"Lauraglu,"
the girl with the lamp said, hesitant.
"Is that be you, Laura my glue?"
"Sadie,"
Lauraglu exclaimed joyfully, running forward.
"Sadie Pepperpot, it is be me. I be coming home, nay?"
"Nay," replied the girl, giving the evil eye to the rest of the group.
"What you bring with you? You bring longbeards to the city?"
Lauraglu shook her head.
"Not longbeards. Caretakers, like Jamie. We got to take them in now."
Still skeptical, the girl turned and trotted off down the tunnel. Lauraglu followed, and Avon went right behind her. The companions brought up the rear, and in a few moments the tunnel gave way to an opening of brick, which came up underneath a large stone fountain of Pegasus. The fountain was in the center of a courtyard, and there, amidst a dozen children running about, a regal, thin-framed man with curly brown hair and a hawkish nose stood and spread his arms in greeting. Lauraglu let out a shriek of joy and ran to the man, leaping into his arms.
"Uncle Daedalus,"
she cried out.
"I did it. I flew all the way to the summer country, and then I flew all the way back. And I brung the caretakers,"
she added,
"even though they're not Jamie."
"You did wonderfully, my little Lauraglu,"
said the man, hugging her tightly, then lowering her to the ground.
"Why don't you see if there's room for a few guests at dinner, ne?"
Still cheshiring from ear to ear, Lauraglu ran off and joined another group of children. Additional shrieks indicated that her greetings were continuing. The man she called Daedalus shook hands with the companions as Bert introduced all of them one by one. When Daedalus got to Avon, he smiled and then kissed her on the forehead.
"My word," said Charles, "I don't think I've ever seen her blush before." "You have been missed," Daedalus said to her. "It brings me joy to see you again, even though the circumstances be grim."
Before he could elaborate, Lauraglu came rushing back, trailing a group of children the likes of which none of them had ever seen. There was a flurry of introductions as Lauraglu rattled off the names of her friends for John, Jack, Charles, and Bert. But again, it was Avon they were focused on, and they looked at her with something akin to awe.
"Is it true?"
asked a lanky, tow-headed boy called Fred the Goat, who had been caught mid-meal and talked with his mouth full.
"Are you really a mother?"
"I am," said Avon,
That's why I've come back. We're searching for my son.
Back?
Asked the girl Laura Glue called Maggie Tree and Leaf, who in fact resembled a bramble bush.
When were you here before? Don't you remember her?
Exclaimed Laura Glue.
This is Poppy. She's come back to us at last.
Fred the goat's mouth dropped open, and a half-chewed carrot fell out.
Poppy Longbottom? For reals?
Poppy Longbottom, said John. Ha! Did you really choose that yourself? Oh, shut up, Avon said over her shoulder. She turned back to Fred the goat. Yes, I'm Poppy. At least I used to be. But you can call me Avon now.
Hmm,
mused the girl named Sadie Pepperpot, who had opened the grate to admit them.
Avon, that's a good mother name. I don't believe her,
said a small boy with a shock of black hair that stuck straight up from his head.
I think she's just another long beard, except, you know, without the beard.
I'll have you know, Pelvis Parsley, Avon said, bending low to look at him an inch from his nose. I am indeed Poppy Longbottom, and I can prove it. She reached inside her blouse and pulled something out of a pocket hidden in the lining. She held her hand in front of Pelvis Parsley's face, then slowly opened it. Resting on her palm was a small silver thimble. Pelvis Parsley's eyes saucered.
Holy socks,
he exclaimed.
You have a kiss from Jimmy. Then you really must be Poppy.
With that, the boy let out a war whoop and began dancing around the room, pulling Avon along by the hand. The other children picked up the yell, and soon the din was overwhelming. You know, Jack said to Daedalus over the clamour, Laura Glue was quite put out if we called her by less than her full name, but it doesn't seem to bother anyone else if she just calls them Poppy or Sadie. Daedalus grinned.
At one point in time, there were no less than 5 Lauras among the Lost Boys, and, as Laura Glue was the smallest of them, she clung very tightly to anything that would make her distinctive. In particular, her name.
Ha! Jack laughed. There's plenty more than just her name that sets that girl apart from the crowd.
Indeed, said Daedalus.
The noise continued as everyone took their places along several long tables, laden with dishes and plates, all of which were empty.
Ah, is the food still being prepared?
Asked Charles.
Or have you already finished eating?
Finished?
Said Fred the goat.
We barely got started. I'm only 2 courses in.
How many courses are there? Asked John.
11-7, replied Fred. Unless you count dessert, then there's more.
Good heavens, Jack exclaimed. That's a lot of courses. Who prepares it all? Laura Glue laughed.
We all do, gravy head. You uses your imagination, Longbeard, said Sadie Pepperpot. That's what makes the world interesting, you know.
I suppose you'd have to, noted Jack, to have 11-7 courses. It all sounds grand to me, said John, as long as I don't have to clean up afterward.
That's the best part about an imaginary feast, explained Laura Glue. You can simply imagine that all the mess that's left over gets cleaned up by an imaginary feast beast, and as soon as you do, it's done. Oh, they're just long beards,
Pelvis scoffed.
I bet they don't even know how to use their imaginations.
Bert leaned close to the shock-headed boy and wiggled his nose.
That's where you'd be mistaken, my boy, he said. If imagination is your cook, then these 3 fellows will make the greatest feast the Lost Boys have ever seen.
And with that cue, John, Jack and Charles smiled and began to think of the most extraordinary foods they could dream of. And even Pelvis Parsley's usual sour expression could not hold back the shrieks of delight he uttered when the first incredible dishes began to appear on the tables. Chapter 16. Echoes Well. Even if it had not been the most exceptional dinner they had ever attended, which it was, the companions would have stayed through to the end just to watch the children use their own imaginations to conjure up the feast beasts to clean up the leftovers. The creatures looked like large, furry rats with great dark orbs for eyes and massive claws that were both threatening and delicate.
The feast beasts devoured all the leftover food, then gathered up all the dirty plates and utensils, and ate those as well, before scampering away into one of the buildings. Fred the goat let out a huge belch and smacked his lips.
"Mmm,"
he said contentedly.
"Tasted almost as good coming out as it did going in."
John frowned in distaste, but Charles merely laughed, and Jack let out a belch of his own. Sadie Pepperpot and Laura Glue implored Avon to go with them to see their garden, and the rest of the Lost Boys began playing a tag-like game they called Monster and the Frogs, while Bert and the three caretakers retired to Daedalus's workshop to discuss the recent events that had brought them together. The workshop was what might have been created if Thomas Edison had been allowed to run loose in the British Museum with unlimited resources and a penchant for modernizing old artifacts. There were electrical generators and motors and steam engines wound in and around marble statues, stacks of parchment, and pieces of Roman chariots. Bronze Age armor lay in piles next to archaic telescopes and what appeared to be projection equipment, and in each corner of the expansive room was a brick oven over which hung bubbling cauldrons. The inventor indicated that the companions should sit in several Greek chairs set near the center of the workshop, while he moved from cauldron to cauldron, inspecting the experiments that were evidently still in progress. "Laura Glue told us you were Icarus's brother," said John. "Pardon my asking, but how is that possible?"
"The man you know as Daedalus had two sons," the inventor replied, "Icarus and Iapix. As caretakers, you are evidently well educated enough to know what befell Icarus, and if any of you are fathers, you can imagine the impact that Icarus's death had upon him. My father was one of the great inventors of history. He developed the art of carpentry, and with it invented the saw, axe, plumb line, drill, and even glue. Although," he added ruefully, "the methods of using wax as a fixative turned out to be less successful than he'd hoped."
"He was also a very talented artist, wasn't he?" asked Jack. "Many sculpted wooden figures that have been found throughout Europe have been attributed to Daedalus. It's even said that his works have a touch of the divine." Daedalus the younger nodded.
"It's true, they did. And to some degree, he absorbed that from one of his teachers, a legendary builder named Deucalion."
"Our shipbuilder friend,"
Charles whispered to John.
"My father's problem," the inventor continued, "was pride. Daedalus was so proud of his achievements that he could not bear the idea of a rival, any rival. His own nephew had been placed under his charge to be taught the mechanical arts, and he promptly developed inventions of his own that humiliated my father. Daedalus was so envious of his nephew's accomplishments that when an opportunity arose, he murdered my cousin. And for this crime, my father was tried and punished."
"How was the boy killed?" asked Jack.
"Father pushed him from the top of a high tower," said Daedalus. "And as punishment, he was imprisoned there forever, never again to leave."
"Imprisoned? In a tower?" At this, John and Charles exchanged a startled glance. But Bert gave no indication that it was significant, and Jack was too involved in Daedalus's story to notice.
"And your name?" said Jack. "I'd been the healer for the Argonauts, then followed them to the Trojan conflict," said Daedalus. "I took the name as a way of honoring my father's memory, and then chose to continue his work as well."
"And improved upon his designs," Jack said, "if Laura Glue's wings are any indication."
"Thank you," said Daedalus, smiling. "I've had time to get them just so."
"How did you end up here in the underneath?" asked John. "Or in the archipelago at all, for that matter. We're a long way from Troy."
"A long way now," replied Daedalus,
stirring one of the cauldrons.
"But not then. In those days, the world was more unified. It was easier to travel to all the lands that exist. Many of the places that might be considered mythological by your world's modern standards actually exist. They just take longer to get to than they once did."
Daedalus finished tending to his experiments and took a seat alongside the companions, who proceeded to relate to him all that had happened to them since Laura Glue's arrival in Oxford. The inventor listened attentively, stopping them only